You're listening to episode 6 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. Hi, my name is Klaatu, and this is probably going to be a fairly short episode. I just wanted to get another episode out and not wait until I felt like I had some magical number of things to talk about before releasing something. So a lot of this is kind of listener feedback, which is always kind of fun and interesting to hear. To start with, comments from The Last Known God from IRC and UnixPorn.com. He was playing around with a server and came up with a really, really simple and almost obvious way to get the server to sort of announce itself to you after, for instance, a reboot, which if you think about when you're rebooting a server that is headless, who knows, maybe it doesn't even have a video card in it at this point. Rebooting it is kind of a weird thing for you because you don't really know when it stopped rebooting. You don't know that it's ever really come to the place where it needs to be. I mean, you could walk away from it and just come back in a little while and assume that it's now waiting for you at a login prompt, but hearing a little bit of confirmation is kind of nice. And this is a really simple thing, and it's just kind of beautiful in its simplicity. And the answer is simply to echo, quote, beep, space dash R, space 3, close quote, redirect, slash etsy, slash rc dot d, slash rc dot local, or wherever your rc dot local or local file is located on Slack, where it'd be etsy, rc dot d, slash rc dot local. Red Hat or Fedora, it's going to be slash etsy, slash rc dot local, things like that. The FreeBSD one is something like local.conf or something like that. I forget off the top of my head, but wherever it is, that's where you're going to put this little beep thing. And that, of course, that's kind of the rc.local-ish file is always the last thing that the computer does right before dropping you into the login prompt. And if you'll recall, I did this without really thinking that I was doing this when I was doing the eSpeak computer for my blind friend. I needed a way to tell my blind friend that, hey, your computer's booted up now, you're at a login prompt. And so I had, I think, eSpeak or Festival or something, it was eFlight, I think, is the name of it. And that, I had it say, please log in now or something like that, right at the last line of rc.local after it had loaded all your custom modules that maybe you are having it load or whatever, having it announce itself right there at the end of rc.local kind of works. And so obviously for this, the Last Known Gods solution here, the echo beep dash r3 into rc.local is going to be dependent upon beep. So you need to have beep installed, which depending on your system, depending on the distro that you downloaded and whether you downloaded a really, really minimal live CD versus a full featured big DVD with everything on it, you may or may not have beep installed, but it's certainly in your repository. Just do a yum search beep or an apt-cache search beep, whatever. So there you go. I also learned a little bit about copying lately, and there's a couple of different things about this that might be of interest. Copying, I don't know why I did this last time, but I was copying some files for a friend, actually their whole home directory, and for whatever reason I decided to use copy instead of rsync, and I'm really, really not sure why I did that. I don't recall. It was a really bizarre kind of odd thing that I did, because usually I use rsync. If it's going to be the whole home directory, might as well just rsync it over to some other drive, and then that retains pretty much all the information about those files, as far as I've ever noticed. Now, I guess I didn't really think about things like timestamps and things like that. And so I just copied everything. I just did a copy -rv slash home slash foo over to slash media slash backup drive slash foo. And so it was just copying the home folder completely over to this hard drive, and then they were going to do like a reinstall. Didn't think about it, just kind of did it. Did the reinstall, copied everything back from the backup drive to the computer, and a few days later, my friend called me up and said, hey, all my timestamps are reading the day that we'd copied all the data, meaning that when they wanted to sort their information by the date it was last modified or the date created or anything like that, everything was the same date. Oops. And there are two possibilities here, and it's very unscientific that I don't know which I did, but I know that I did the copy-rv. I think it was like an EXT drive or something normal like that. So I believe that simply that I used copy-rv, and I read the CP man page and found a little switch that might be kind of nice to know about, which is the dash P switch, which stands for preserve. And that does copy by and it preserves all the timestamps and ownership and you know everything that you would typically want to have preserved when you're copying something over from one drive to another, especially when it's kind of a, okay, we're going to update the system now, so we want everything, when we come back, we want everything to look exactly the same. So CP-P is kind of nice to know about. So a lot of times now, added to my usual copy command, rather than just doing copy-rv or copy-v, it would be copy-prv or pv. So it's a good one to know about, and it's kind of nice to use. On a related note, Thrice in IRC had mentioned to me after my episode on file compression and stuff that the 7-zip program does not preserve permissions at all, or ownership information, or anything like that. It's apparently a little application that was actually, and I don't know if I remember this or not, but it was actually developed first for Windows, and then it was ported to Unix and Linux, or something like that. So it doesn't bother with permissions and things like that, because the system that it was originally developed for doesn't really do that. So, I mean, that could be an advantage, it could be a disadvantage, it kind of depends on what your purposes are, I guess. It does mention that in the 7-zip man page as well, so if I'd maybe read up on it a little bit more, I would have known that. Although, honestly, I don't know that, that's not something I usually notice when I'm doing stuff on my computer for myself. You know, it takes a little bit of interaction with other people to start noticing, oh, gee, why can you look at that file? I thought I'd marked that as mine. And then you look at it and you realize, oh, well, I 7-zipped that. Maybe that's why, you know, things like that. You don't really notice it until it kind of burns you in some way. So Thrice mentioned this to me, and I read up on it, and sure enough, he's correct. Does not preserve permissions. So the way that you could still use 7-zip if you like the program, which I still do, I mean, I think it's a nice program. I would just as soon use just the plain old XZ function, which is the compressor that I think might come by default with LZMA, possibly. I'm not really sure, but XZ utils or XZ is what you would find it under. On Slackware, it's just XZ, and then you can compress files. So if you want the LZMA compression, and you don't necessarily want to use 7-zip, you could use XZ. But if you like 7-zip for other things, like its multi-threaded capability, so that it's actually using both your processors to compress things, or whatever it does that is so magical and fast, then you could first tar your files. You know, if you've got, well, even one file, you could just tar that file. Tar, of course, will grab all the permissions and ownership information and all that kind of metadata, and then 7-zip the tar. Simple enough. Another comment, I think, from possibly Thrice, possibly the last known god, I don't know, someone in IRC, was that MPD, which is the music player daemon that I was messing around with, I think, on the previous episode, I was saying that by default, its little config folder is in /var/maybe /mpd/db and /log, things like that. That essentially was putting everything in /var. And I was assuming that it was doing that because it was going to be run as root ultimately anyway. Turns out that mpd proper does not do that. That is not the mpd default. That is the Debian default. And I was configuring mpd on a Debian PowerPC system because Debian is basically the only PowerPC supporter out there right now. I mean, any serious PowerPC supporter. You can get others that are kind of doing some PowerPC support. But Debian is still treating PowerPC just like any other architecture, so it's really kind of V1 that you're going to be using if you're going to venture onto PowerPC. So I was setting up this a G4 466 megahertz tower with Debian on it, and I'm playing a lot around with some of the more server kinds of features like Apache, MPD, what else? Those are the two big ones, I guess. And I was noticing that, for whatever reason, when you look at the documentation of the project, and you look at what's happening on the Debian system, it really is quite different. And I don't know what I think about that, but obviously the Debian maintainers have every right to reorganize the system in whatever way they want to. So that's what they're kind of doing in some small, subtle ways. So things like making the MPD default go to /var/whatever. little things like that you just have to kind of be aware of, and that is one of them, that the MPD / var / MPD default stuff is not what it is according to MPD. So if you install MPD on any other platform, it's going to default to your home directory, to a .mpd directory, and then stash all of its configuration files in there. So feel free to take advantage of that if you want to. You can change that in the configuration file, and it would work just as well. Plus, the documentation would then match what your system looks like. The Debian maintainers also changed the default user from, I think, nobody to MPD, which I found a little bit confusing because that really does assume that you're going to either create a user called MPD and only run MPD as that user or something. That really confused me. That took me quite some time to figure out that that user was not supposed to be called MPD because that looked so official and so premeditated. That user, of course, like I said in the last episode or whenever I was talking about this stuff, is supposed to be the user that you're going to log in as when you start controlling MPD. So watch out for that as well. But otherwise, yeah, MPD is still really cool, and you should definitely check it out. Two more comments, one of which is actually from me. So GIMP, GNU Image Manipulation Program. I've been using it as usual lately, but lately one of the unusual things I've been doing is using it with someone who, for their normal day job, uses Photoshop quite frequently. So, of course, whenever you're in that situation, you become sort of hyper-aware, hyper-sensitive of some of the GIMP's quirks. Some of them are a matter of preference, of course. If you don't care to hit M for your move tool, you would rather hit V for your move tool. You can go into your preferences and literally change all of your keyboard shortcuts, pretty much. No problem. Some of them are a little bit more practical, but could still be argued to be a matter of preference. For instance, when you're going in to scale an image, the fact that if you hit return to accept the fact that you're scaling the image, if you're not exactly in the right place, then you might be actually hitting return on the little chain link that links the aspect ratio of the picture together, and you've just deactivated that, and you're wondering why you're sitting there hitting return like in pretty much any other program, and it's not accepting it like it would in any other program. So that's a little bit, I feel like that's an issue, but it is arguably a matter of design and a matter of preference, because some people might love that functionality. Some other things are a little bit, I guess, old school. I mean, they work, and it's fine, but it does feel a little bit of out of date. For instance, if you get your rotate tool, Shift-R, to rotate a layer, the fact that you don't really get a true preview of what that rotation is going to look like until you have actually committed to the rotation. Now, if that's the only layer that you're dealing with and you're rotating it, yeah, you see a pretty good preview as you rotate. But if it's something that you want to rotate and kind of see it along with the rest of the picture, then really the only way to do that is to go ahead and commit to the rotation, and then you see it, and maybe that works, maybe it doesn't. If this is a question of lining something up just so, that becomes really tedious because you rotate it to such a degree, and then, well, maybe it was off a little bit, so then you have to undo and hit rotate again and try it again. So it becomes fairly tedious. But again, it's certainly not a deal breaker, obviously, because I'm still using GIMP and still loving it. So it's just something that exists, I guess. And again, I became hyper aware of it when I was using GIMP with a typical Photoshop user. I mean, not a typical, but like someone who usually uses Photoshop. And they're very good on Photoshop. They know a lot of the conventions and sort of methods of doing things on Photoshop. That's a weird place to be, because a lot of their opinions, therefore, are simply, oh, this isn't like Photoshop, therefore it must be wrong. And so you have to kind of hear what they're saying and then kind of filter it out for yourself and think, well, yeah, it might be different, but it works for me. And the bottom line, of course, is always that it probably works. I mean, if it works for you, then it works for you, and GIMP works for me. I have to date probably gotten more things published in printed magazines with the GIMP and Inkscape than a lot of my friends who work in Illustrator and Photoshop and InDesign, So, I mean, the results kind of speak for themselves in that sense. But that none of that's really what I wanted to talk about. I just wanted to kind of bring that up as an issue and kind of a response to that perceived issue. But one issue that I'm still being, I guess, plagued by is the scaling algorithm in GIMP. And this strikes me as a real thing that I would like to know more about, I guess, and possibly hear back from people if they have a lot of experience with this sort of thing. But there is obviously going to be a loss of quality from any application other than like a vector-based application. But any render, any bitmap kind of graphics application, there's going to be a loss in quality if you scale an image down from, say, 1600 by 1200 pixels to 400 by 300 pixels. You're asking the computer to lose pixels. You know, you're asking it to take away pixels from a picture that has X number of pixels. You want it to end up with fewer pixels. You're therefore losing quality. You're losing pixels. You're relying on a computer to sort of do those calculations for you. Sometimes it's going to work really well. Sometimes it's not. So I understand that. Now let's talk about what kind of images I'm talking about, because I am actually speaking about fairly specific ones. Two images that I can think of would be a photograph, which would be a collection of pixels, and there's no real separation for the computer as to where pixels begin and where pixels are. You know, it's all pixels. There's no objects in there. That would be one kind of graphic. And those actually, GIMP scales down really, really well. That seems to be not a problem. I think that's because you, to your human eye, you know, if a photograph of a person or a flower or a building gets scaled down from 1600 by 1200 to 400 by 300, the edges of the face separated from the background, you know, there is a little bit of a blur there anyway, right? That's built into a photograph. Your eye understands that that's where the face ends and the background begins. Our eyes correct for that sort of thing, so it's, you know, obviously, like I say, there's got to be a loss of quality there, but to my eye, to anyone else's eye, we don't notice that. That works fine. The kinds of graphics that I'm having issues with are graphics that have been designed in some program and are being brought into either GIMP or Photoshop, for instance, and they have alpha channels, meaning that there is a very definite separation between the pixels and the lack of pixels, meaning that you've got some hard edges there, or maybe they're curved edges, whatever. There's specific lines there where there should be, where there's an image, and there's a very specific kind of place where it should stop. Scaling these down seemed to be really, really difficult for GIMP, because when you do that, the edges become really, really blurred, or they become jagged, or they become mottled or splotchy. It's just really, really a problem. Text as well, like text that has been flattened out, you know, so it's no longer a vector glyph. It's now a bitmap representation of something that our eyes recognize as a letter. That's just horrible. That's horrific, in fact. And I've tried this on all of the different algorithms that GIMP offers. The interpolation algorithms is what they call. Actually, all four. There's none. There's linear, there's cubic, and then there's sync, otherwise known as Lanczos 3, whatever. I've tried it on all of these. I've tried it with every kind of graphical image, and pretty much consistently, it's really, really bad results when you're scaling these kinds of graphics down in drastic measures. Now, once again, any graphic artist is going to tell you that if you're going from 1600 by 1200 to 400 by 300, you would never want to do that as one chunk. I don't care what program you're using. Photoshop, Corel, GIMP, Krita, bitmap graphic applications. You don't want to just go from 1600 by 1200 to 400 by 300 without any kind of increment, or I guess decrement, in between. So if you would rather go from like 1600 by 1200 to, let's say, 1200 by 800, and then to 800 by 600, and then 400 by 300. My math could be a little bit wrong, but you get the idea. You go in steps. Some people are really crazy about it and only go in like 10 pixel increments or 100 pixel increments. You know, they go step by step by step by step. And that preserves some of the quality. So I've tried all of that on GIMP as well. Doesn't really help, to be honest. It's still at a certain point, it just starts to become really, really blurry. The obvious answer to blur being introduced would be to use a sharpen filter. And in fact, that helps quite a bit. Therefore, what you would want to do if you're going to be scaling images, again, with alpha channels, mostly. I mean, I really haven't had a problem with straight photographs where it's all just a big jumble of pixels. It's been fine. Although, like I say, flattened text seems to be a little bit of an issue. That's a different story. It could be flattened text on a completely flat surface, no alpha channel involved. Scaling that down, you start to really lose the sharp quality on that text really, really quickly. So for those and for things with alpha channel, you can try this. What I've been doing is scaling down in increments, in bite-sized chunks, not so religiously that it will take me all day to scale down an image. Like going from 1600 by by 1200 to 400 by 300, it would take me all day to scale down by 10 pixel increments. And there is actually a plugin for GIMP called Step Scale or something like that, and that that is supposed to scale an image down in increments of up to, I think, 20. And then I once I'm finished, I simply go into Filters, Enhance, and then Sharpen, and gives you a little preview of what amount your sharpening is going to give you. It usually is a question of like a 10 pixel threshold of sharpening. It might even be less. It just kind of depends on what you're doing. Overall, I looked at the Photoshop implementation of their scaling tool, and I discovered that actually, their default algorithm, and I don't remember what it's called, the default one that they use, it might be actually called Cubic as well, I'm not 100% sure, actually combines, it actually has a sharpen filter built in. So people doing Photoshop rescaling and loving the results are actually doing the two-step process that I'm doing without realizing it. So they're scaling something down with whatever algorithm Photoshop is providing, and then they're using the sharpen tool behind the user's back in a way. I mean, it says with sharpen mask or something like that. So I mean, it does let the user know, but it's just one of those things that you've seen every day if you're a Photoshop user, so it just kind of fades into the background. But yeah, so they're actually sharpening it themselves as an automatic kind of last process in the scaling function, and people just don't realize it because they don't notice that it says with sharpen mask or with sharpening or whatever it says. And you can look at that. This person was using CS5, and if you go to the scaling tool, I think it's called Image Resize possibly or something like that, then yeah, it's right there. It says scale down, and then you go to what algorithm you want to use, and it's something like Cubic with sharpen, and I'm pretty sure that's the default. At least it was their default. So there you have it. Whether or not, like in the end, I mean, that's a happy ending. Whether or not GIMP scaling needs work, I feel kind of like it does, because I still feel a little bit hesitant every time that I scale something down, simply because of those first couple of initial times lately where I was scaling stuff down and it was really getting degraded in quality and kind of scared me away from scaling too much in GIMP. I've also been trying to do comparisons of the scaling in GIMP versus, say, ImageMagick, things like that. Krita, honestly, I can't even get it to stay open long enough to do a scaling. It just seems to be crashing all the time lately, so I'm not bothering with that. But I haven't finished any kind of proper test on scaling results on GIMP versus ImageMagick. And for all I know, GIMP is just calling ImageMagick. I mean, I really haven't even looked into it whatsoever. But yeah, that's the tip for GIMP. Scale down and then sharpen, and your results will be a lot better than if you just scale. And yes, that's what Photoshop is doing too, so no fear. Well, let's have a quick coffee break, and then we'll come back for a little bit more feedback, and then some observations on system migration, and then the end of the show. And finally, I don't know if this really counts as listener feedback or not. I kind of think it is. Some guy named, I think, David, wrote an article for Linux Journal about video editors and Linux, which, I mean, frankly, is a bold article to try to write, I think. But he did. He wrote it. It's a whole series, and if you've been getting Linux Journal, you probably already know the one I'm talking about. If I recall correctly, he started with Kdenlive. But in an article very recently called Open Movie Editor and Blender, and Jesse James actually told me about this article, so thanks, Jesse James, in IRC. And you, if you look at it and you read it, and it's a good article, it's great, talks about Open Movie Editor, which, by the way, I tried. It's cool. It's really neat. I'm not in love with it. And then it goes down and talks about Blender, which, of course, I've used for quite some time to do editing. And again, in my opinion, it's kind of, well, up until Autour, it was the most stable and reliable video editor for Linux. But surprise, surprise, this guy, whoever this guy is, David or whatever, references me. He, like, totally talks about me. He says Klaatu. He says he followed a web tutorial by Klaatu and links to the tutorial and everything. So this is like that old Blender tutorial that I did in probably season 4 or something, and I just kind of left it online, you know, because, I mean, it's a good tutorial, I guess, and it's there, and it exists, this, and yeah, it turns out he followed it. And I think I remember this guy from IRC. I think he popped on IRC a couple of times and was asking me for some specifics. So yeah, it was really cool to be actually like cited or whatever in Linux Journal of all places. So I was really flattered and wanted to thank David for that. I don't know if he actually even knows I have an Ogcast. Probably not, but if he does, then there you go. So more broadly, to make this mention not so much about me, although that's obviously why I mentioned it, it's really great to see, I guess, it feels like more multimedia people getting involved with Linux and starting to kind of speak up for, yeah, hey, we need more multimedia stuff on Linux. Because I realize that in terms of stability and reliability and stuff, Linux has the server space really, really down. They've got that covered. We're great on server. I mean, to the point that you can't find fault with it, I don't think. It's just so good. And the multimedia stuff just needs a little bit more attention, I think. So it's good to hear people talking about that more. And speaking of that, Jay Lindsay and a couple of people, MonsterBee, a lot of people told me about this little magazine that just came out called Libre Graphics Magazine. And it's online as well as print. You can find it. I mean, this is their first inaugural issue, so there's one out there, you know, that's the only issue out. But it's a really great magazine, Libre Graphics Magazine. It's all about, obviously, graphics on free software and stuff. And it's really, really cool to hear about this kind of world being exposed to potential and current Linux users, because this is an important place. You know, I mean, computing is, it's more than just servers, obviously, and it's more than just the office work that people do on OpenOffice or whatever, and it's more than just programming. I mean, it is all of those things, but it's also multimedia, you know, especially nowadays. I mean, come on, HTML5 is all about multimedia, so Linux wants to be more established in multimedia, I think. And I don't think the answer is to pander to Adobe and other places that might magically come in and rescue us all from not being a multimedia platform. It's simply about cultivating people who know about graphics and people who know about programming, and kind of getting them to speak to each other and then to make stuff happen toward a better multimedia platform. So I think that's starting to happen even more now than ever, and that's an exciting development. So check out Libre Graphics, check out Linux Journal, look at my name, it's in print, it's really cool, and check out other multimedia projects. Speaking of other multimedia projects, I think it was, yeah, it must have been the last episode I talked about the video editing with InPlayer idea, and was talking about my little proof of concept set of bash scripts that basically implements video editing as it really should be, which is with a InPlayer that plays everything and simply edits with numbers, which is how editing is supposed to be done since the early 1900s. So that was a great episode. It worked, you know, the proof of concept thing worked. And lately, Rowing Golfer, as I mentioned in the show notes of last episode, has been playing around with that idea and has actually implemented quite a lot of it in a little video editor that you too can try out if you want. It's very early in its life, in its development. I mean, it's only about maybe two weeks old, and it doesn't even have a timeline yet. It is not yet a video editor, and yet it is, and it follows the exact principles of what I was talking about. So it's still being called Auteur, it's Rowan Golfer's code. He's done it in Python 2 and 3, so you should go over and check it out. I'll have a link to his Git repository in the show notes. In terms of Git itself, I want to talk about a couple of quick commands just to get you started. Git, of course, is a version control system. They use it for the Linux kernel. I used to use it quite a bit at my old job as well. Now, my old job had me using it in a very limited sense. I mean, I used it every day, but they were very, very conscious of noobs like me completely breaking the nightly build by committing something that doesn't work. So I'm not super great on Git, but I do like Git a lot. And so the first thing to use it, of course, you'll need to install it. So you do a yum install git. If you're running Slackware, you already have it. However you need to get it, I'm sure you can figure that part out. It's in your repository. So there's git. And the first thing that you want just to do probably is clone a repository that someone has online. So the way to do that would be to say git gitorius.org/rowinggolfer/auteur, for instance. I don't think that's not the correct URL, but let's say it is. So you're cloning that, meaning that you're pulling all the code down from his repository and making an exact duplicate of it on your local machine. You can do this into a specific folder if you want. You can do a git clone gitorius.org/rowinggolfer/auteur/auteur, and then it will clone all of that into something called auteur. You could call it anything you want as well. You could call it video editor dash auteur or whatever. So that clones the repository into a directory. Now, then if you cd into that directory, you'll see all the code that's there, and you can read the readme and go into q_auteur, I think, or pyqt_auteur, something like that. That's where Rowing Golfer's code is. The rest of it's my little proof of concept stuff that I imagine isn't very useful at this point. You can go in there, you can run it, you can read the readme, all that other good stuff. If you make changes to code, if you're just trying to mess around with it or whatever, then no worries, you can always do that. The issue will be that when you want to update the code to the latest version of the code, it will start to conflict with things because you've got different code in your repository, and Git tries to protect you from erasing all of your changes. So if you're not making any changes, then to get the latest and greatest version of the code, like 3 days from now, would be to do a git pull, and then it knows the branch to pull, so it'll just pull down all the latest updates and integrate it with the code that's right there in your system. And now you're running the latest version of PyQt, or of PyQt_auteur, whatever it's called, qAuteur, I think. And that's great. Like I say, if you've made changes, then you need to either go ahead and get your own repository and commit your changes. Otherwise, if you are okay with overwriting your changes and everything, it will tell you when you try to do a git pull that there's some kind of conflict. It'll say that there are unsaved or uncommitted changes to foobar.py to say that that's all right. What you need to do is git checkout foobar.py, and that will check out one file, which is foobar.py, and it will overwrite your local copy to with the checked out version. Now you're all back to sort of a normal, what would be called the head of that branch. You're back where that branch started. Note, there's nothing different about your version and the official version of that code. So now you can do a git pull, and it will pull again all of the changes and update your code. And now you're back and running the latest code. I guess the big commands that you're going to be dealing with if you're new to Git would be git clone to get a copy of it. Git clone gitorius.org/foo. That creates a local copy of that repository. Git pull will pull all the latest code into your branch. And then git checkout will just cherry pick little changes, single files from the master branch, and download it to your local machine. There are obviously ways to merge your changes and to create your own repository and commit your changes, all kinds of cool things that you can do. But those are the really, really basic commands to kind of be able to get the code, make changes to it, overwrite your changes, get the latest code, things like that. So I think that's about it. So have a look at the code if you want, and have fun with it and test it out and stuff like that. And or don't test it out. I mean, it's not really something I don't think that we're taking bug reports on yet. I mean, it's still very, very early in its development, so it's really something to look at and just kind of see how it's coming along. And maybe if you're some brilliant Python person, maybe make some changes to it or something, or additions. I'm not really sure, but it's pretty neat. It's really quite interesting to look at, and it's very exciting, to be honest, because it's the most reliable video editor I've tried on Linux, and one of the quicker ones too. So yay for MPlayer, yay for Python, and especially yay for Rowing Golfer. That's really, really cool stuff. So one more thing, Lost in Bronx tried out my Audacity config file from Slacker Media. This is my config file that really capitalizes on logical keyboard commands to do the typical functions of Audacity that you would, and he actually had a lot of good things to say about it.
Klaatu, I just wanted to let you know that I tried your default settings for Audacity, putting it in, and I love them. I'm a bona fide Klaatu default settings fanboy. I grabbed it off of Slacker Media. I love it. I wouldn't go back. It took me a couple hours just to get used to it, but it was a lot easier than I thought it would be. So, thumbs up, buddy.
So if you haven't tried my Audacity config file yet, do go to slackermedia.info and look around for Audacity and download my config file and see if you like it. Look at the keyboard shortcuts first and then try it out because it's really cool. Okay, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit, just briefly, about system migration. System migration is something that I'm calling, possibly incorrectly, I'm not really sure, what you do when you are installing a new OS on your computer and you're bringing over your old home folder. And I've been doing this a lot lately, and I've been doing it a lot on different operating systems. At my new job, which has me administering a lot of Macintosh clients, but running a Linux network on the back end. But at this new job, I've been doing that quite often, and I've noticed that the person who had this job before me has actually been migrating with the OS X built-in migration assistant, which, as far as I can tell, just copies the home folder over to the new Mac. It seems to honestly blindly copy the preferences over, which is where Mac, they don't use the .foo file in your home directory convention in Mac OS X. They stuff all the user preferences in a user library right there in their user directory in their home folder, which they call /users with a capital U, and then the username. So it's in their own private library in a folder called preferences. And this folder seems to be blindly copied over because on a lot of these people's systems that I've been updating and trying to fix, there have been preference files dating back literally from like 2003, I think, is the earliest I've seen so far. Certainly for applications that no longer exist. So it seems to be doing this pretty blindly. I'm not going to say completely blindly. I mean, I'm going to assume that there's some kind of optimization occurring, some kind of allowance for the fact that maybe the dock preferences have changed since, the days of Jaguar. So there's that. I've also been doing a lot of system migration on KDE systems for various people. And I know that when you update or migrate from an old KDE to the new KDE, it does run some kind of migration tool, some kind of migration assistant or something like that, that's supposed to bring in stuff. I'm not really sure what it is, what it's doing exactly, but it runs the first time you launch KDE. Both of these have given me problems. Mac OS X seems to break regularly if you blindly copy things like preferences over and make no allowance for the fact that some of the key applications that you're using on your new system have changed, or some of the applications that they used to use are now not even around anymore. And on KDE, the same kind of deal seems to happen. It seems that when you copy over your entire, for instance, .kde folder and drop it into your home directory, and you've got a new KDE, little things will go wrong. To the extent, I think, that KDE won't even start properly. I could be a little bit wrong on that. But, there's just a little bit of, sometimes there's a little bit of a difference. And it seems like migration issues can occur. It's been an interesting sort of test between the two systems, and it seems like Mac OS X manages to hide the breakage quite well, meaning that you can do this magical migration, or even a blind migration on your own with rsync, where you're copying everything. It's still blind. You're not really sorting through anything and saying, well, we don't need that. Oh, this is substantially changed. Let's ditch the old preferences and let it create new preferences, things like that. But it seems to hide the breakage pretty well initially. So if you've got preferences that seem to conflict with the implementation of something, the new implementation of something, it just kind of glosses over that, and you don't notice that there's anything broken until something starts going completely wrong, 3 months down the line, and you don't really know why, and suddenly you're sitting there clearing out all these preference files from a person's system, and then suddenly everything starts magically working like it was supposed to in the first place. So it's one of those things where it's broken, but no one notices until I guess it becomes necessary to use, you know, some things in conjunction with each other or whatever. So that's a problem for OS X for sure. And then on KDE, it seems to simply not hide it at all. And if there's a conflict, so far I've had major breakage, just like KDE won't start or the panel disappears or crashes or something. Which one is better, which one is worse, I don't know that I can say. And I don't know that there's an easy solution for it either, because I gather that preference files or the .kde/share/config/whatever files can be quite unique per system. And so I don't suppose that you can just create a script that says, go into this preference file, and if this old option exists, then delete that line, or if this old option exists, change its name to such and such, and change its value to the new default, or whatever. I don't know if that would be possible. Like, literally, I don't know how complex that would be. It sounds complex to me, but then what do I know? So, yeah, there's that, and so it's a tough call, but it is something to be aware of, I think, that when you're migrating from one version of a system to another, keep in mind that some of your important preference files might have changed, or might have become deprecated, or might now conflict with the new way of doing things, and if you're having any issues, that would be probably your first stop, is the .kde file, and look around in there and see if there's anything that looks like something is breaking, you know. If it's something in Plasma, look for that Plasma RC file, or maybe Kwin RC. Little things like that are a good thing to keep in mind, because the first time it happened to me, I kind of panicked. I didn't know what was going on or why it was not working, and then I kind of started poking around and figured out, okay, here's where the files that dictate what all this stuff is going to look like and how it acts. And then it starts to work again. The thing about you can't just not bring over, for instance, the .kde directory or the preferences file in Mac OS X, for that matter. If you just don't bring those over, you're losing all kinds of things. You know, you're losing bookmarks. You're losing possibly mail. Email. You know, you'll lose a lot of stuff. So it's not something that you necessarily want to just get rid of. What I've been doing on both systems lately is renaming the .kde file. Rename it .kde-old, or, you know, renaming the old preferences file in Mac. Get the system back up and running, get everything at its default value, and then start to kind of parse through the preferences on Mac or the .kde/share/config/everything files, and see what you can bring over, what's important, what's not important, and that kind of helps a lot. It also keeps your system a little bit more tidy, again, in both places, because how often have I installed, for instance, Amarok just for kicks, and then never use it? So then I'm reinstalling or updating or something, and I decide not to install Amarok because I know that I never use it. But there's an Amarok RC file in my .kde/share/config files, so do I really need to copy that over? Probably not. So it helps me keep a little bit more focused by going through those files. And that's it. My name is Klaatu. This has been GNU World Order, Episode 6 of Season 6. You can find me online at Freenode, irc.freenode.net, as not Klaatu. You can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can IM me at notklaatu@jabber.org. And you can go to the website at ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.
Dragonlance. You are closer than you know.